lighted. Let our circle be strong and full of medicine. Hear me. This is my dream song that I'm singing for you. This is my power song that is taking me to the edge. This is rock medicine, the talking tree, the singing water. Listen, I am dancing underneath you. This was the way of it. It is a river. It is a chant. It is a medicine story. It is what happened long ago. It is a bead in a story belt. It is what has been forgotten. It is a smell of sweet grass and cedar and prayers up to the sky, Father. It is a way, a tradition, the way it was always done by the people. It is a feeling of warmth, the sound of voices. Listen, I am dancing underneath you.
Hello, Kevin.
Yes.
Hi, this is Aeolus calling.
Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Good.
So we're recording now, are we?
We are indeed, yes.
Okay.
I'll give you a rundown of what I had in mind. Obviously, all of your listeners, all of the people who follow your work are going to be very familiar with what you've been doing over the past 15 years or so. I would think that many, if not most, of my listeners are not. If you could just start then, I know it's a tough call, but to try and give a summation of your work over the past years, however long it's been, and your own experiences, I mean, how things have played out, because I know, having seen Unrepentant, I know that it's had some enormous implications or repercussions in your own personal life. So maybe if you could just give for our listeners a run-through of your experiences and up to date.
Well, in for about 15 years ago, this story started for me when I became after I had been ordained as a United Church minister. I went out to the west coast of Canada, on Vancouver Island. I was called as a minister to a United Church there in central Vancouver Island, a town called Port Alberni, which had been the center of a lot of the missionary invasion, if you like, in the latter part of the 1800s. And the church that I belonged to back then, the United Church, had come out of the Methodist and Presbyterian traditions, and they and the Catholics were very active in that area, if you like, grabbing a lot of land, because the way it worked was back then the Crown declared that it owned all the land, and it parceled out the land to various missionary groups and churches. And ironically, that was the issue that got me fired after 3 years in Port Alberni, because I found out that the church had been selling off native land acquired that way to various logging companies for kickbacks, and this was an issue that I helped to surface, and which, you know, caused quite a stir and got me fired. But in the history of it is simply the fact that the churches and government colluded in not only taking the land from the native tribes all over here, all over this part of, all over the continent, really, but they then set about to really engage in what's clearly genocide. The population of the native groups here on the West Coast declined by up to 90% in two generations. Mm-hmm. We have cases of villages of 500 people going down to 20 or 30 people in the space of one generation.
Right.
And this was deliberately through a policy of spreading smallpox and tuberculosis that's really been established now, including by documentation. I found that when I got to Port Alberni in 1992 as a minister, it was a very segregated kind of community, and that Native people and whites didn't really mix. They didn't seem to want to mix at all. And I tried to change that. I began to invite Native people into my church. We opened a food bank. But one incident that kind of illustrates for me how I began to learn about this is in the month I got there, I visited the first Native family I visited was a Native fisherman, Danny Gus, his name was, and I asked him why Native people weren't coming to my church at all. And he said that his best friend had been killed in the Alberni residential school that had been run by the United Church for 50 years or more. He said he had been killed there and buried in the hill out back, and the people in the church knew that, and they just didn't want anything to do with Native people because of that guilty conscience, if you like, and their criminal liability for that death. And I began to hear these stories more and more all over the place. So that kind of is how it really the story began for me in the course of my work as a minister. I not only heard those stories, but I saw the impact on the ground in the Native world. Very high rate of suicide, violence. All of it's the legacy of the brutality and suffering that happened in these so-called schools. Mm-hmm. And I can also give a little bit of a background, if you like, on that. The residential schools were set up by the Government of Canada and the churches in the latter part of the 1800s. And it was a law that every Native child had to go to these schools or their parents would go to jail. And the government statistics as early as 1920 were showing that half the children were dying in these residential schools because of uncontrolled disease, a practice of deliberately housing healthy kids with sick ones and then letting them die en masse. My theory is that this was a plan of depopulation. This was a way of getting the Native people off the last of the land in order to get the lands and resources. And it worked very effectively. Now the Native people here are barely 2% of the population, and where they were once the majority.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned something, evidence of experimentation was also going on Native children, is that right?
Well, that came out over the years. I mean, like I say, one of the things I learned after I was fired for bringing out a lot of this stuff, I began to work on a doctoral degree at the University of British Columbia. And I began to find reports and records of medical experimentation that had happened in Indian hospitals that were set up jointly by the government and the churches. And I've interviewed dozens of eyewitnesses, people who lived through these experiments. Right here in Vancouver Island, there's groups of people who survived the Nanaimo Indian Hospital, where Native kids were taken in and sterilized en masse, especially if they were connected to chiefs or traditional leaders in the community. They were targeted for sterilization. And there was even an incentive program where the government was paying doctors hundreds of dollars for every Native woman they sterilized. All of that's been brought out by testimony and documents. And it spanned a very long period of time. It wasn't just, you know, a few weird people doing these experiments. It was definitely a whole government program in place.
Hmm. So besides being fired from the church, what other repercussions did you experience when you began to uncover and publicize this?
Well, the first threats came up when I was still a minister. They told me basically I had to back this off or I'd lose my job. I'd back off from looking into this. But after I was fired, to give you an example, the church officers went to my wife at the time and offered to, they encouraged her to divorce me, and they offered to even pay for her divorce, which they subsequently did, if she would provide them information about me. And they subsequently gave her documents, which tried to make me look, you know, the allegation was that I was mentally unstable in that, although they offered no proof about that. And they helped her win custody of her two small daughters. You know, so helping to have my children taken away from me, they issued a blacklist. I couldn't get a work anywhere. I still can't. It's a very effective smear that's happened on me and my work. They even interfered in my doctoral degree and helped stop funding for my program so that, in fact, I never was able to complete my PhD. So, I mean, it was on many levels. It was physical threats, attempted lawsuits, you know, the usual kind of round of death threats and intimidation, and that kind of thing, which, you know, it doesn't ever really stop because these crimes are not just of the past. These are things that are still going on. In the Native world, there's a lot of pedophilia and child abuse still going on, and these are fairly well-protected pedophile rings involving powerful men. often connected to judges and government officials. We're documenting a lot of this, and in the coming year or two, we're hoping to issue kind of an independent report on this, human rights report, on this kind of activity.
Hmm. Is this restricted to Canada, or is this a global network?
Oh, it's a global network, definitely. In 1999, UNESCO issued a report on child abuse and exploitation around the world, and they named this report, issued about 10 years ago now, they named Rotterdam, Bangkok, and Vancouver, Canada, as the three areas where there was widespread child pornography and prostitution happening. And in all of those places, they identified government and judicial involvement in these networks, both in the protection of perpetrators and concealment and harassment of eyewitnesses and that kind of thing. Similar to what was revealed in Belgium a few years ago, you know, when there was a very extensive pedophile network exposed involving a lot of judges. Mm. I mean, the reality is that these are international networks. Mm. And we've even established that there's a ring operating directly between Vancouver and Bangkok in which, you know, businessmen here go over on what are called sex tours, and they procure children there. And children here regularly disappear from native reserves all over British Columbia. And we've had eyewitnesses describing how they are, you know, part of these sex rings. So, you know, it's widely known in the native world and in other circles, but unfortunately, there's a lot of concealment of this, and the media often refuse to look into any of these allegations.
Mm. It seems almost like an open secret thing. Is it something that I'm hearing more and more about, not just in Canada, but all over the world? In Britain, there's recent publicity involving paedophiliac rings that connected to the government. And it's as though these ideas surface for a while and then they get quickly suppressed. But I wonder, do you think, does it dependent to some extent on the complicity of the public, that people just find it very difficult to assimilate these ideas and to incorporate them with their view of the way things are, the idea that the world could actually be run by a group of individuals who have this kind of disposition and this kind of behavior? It creates a sort of cognitive dissonance, wouldn't you say?
Very much. And that's a big part, just on a human level, that's a big part of the resistance of people have to even accepting that these things can happen. There's a certain safe distance. You know, you can hear about these kinds of things in other countries, and because it's at a distance, you can accept it because it's not a challenge or a threat to your own life. But when you're telling people that it's happening in their own neighborhood, in their own city, the fear reaction that's involved basically causes people to say, well, it couldn't happen to me. It's like, we can't imagine ever being killed. We can't imagine that this would be happening to our neighbor's children or anybody we know. And that's a lot of the reason that these things go undetected, because it isn't just the denial. Once people do know, we get people to the point of accepting, yes, it is happening. The question is, where do you take it? When the authorities themselves are involved in this, when the judges are implicated, when the media is covering it up, literally the only people you have to rely on are yourselves. And alternative media like this interview here and others, getting the truth out, we have to become our own media and our own means of justice, because you can't rely on these institutions, you know, that plan genocide, you know, against Native people or continue to plan these crimes. You can't rely on them to prosecute themselves. So you really it requires an informed and an activated populace, armed with the information and willing to do something, willing to challenge their own systems of power. Mm. That takes a lot of work, and it happens, you know, but it takes a lifetime commitment. And it's not something you can simply dabble in. You really have to tell people that, you know, you have to change the priorities in your life. You have to stop worrying simply about your own life and look at what's happening to the world around you and the people around you.
In your lectures and discussions on this subject, you go into Christian history all the way from its inception to the present and the institution of what's known as Christendom. And it seems that you're really mapping an agenda. And we talk about the Catholic Church actually becoming a corporation in 317 and fusing with the Roman Empire. And so I guess you could say that the Roman Empire has survived to this day in the form of the Catholic Church. So we're talking about agendas and policies and what have you that are at least a couple of millennia old, if not longer. and that are persisting today, and that it seems that what you're uncovering, what started it seemed like a local problem, you've gone deeper and deeper and found that this is a global problem or situation that has been going on for thousands of years. How exactly do you, presumably at some point you have to take it to another paradigm, particularly
yeah.
as a Christian, that you're seeing something that it seems the scope of it seems almost beyond human comprehension.
Yeah, well, it, in one sense it is, but it's understandable if you look at it in a historical context where this comes from. And it's been talked about in many other circles, the subversion of Christ's message and its replacement with an institution called the church. You subverted Christ's most basic teaching of love your enemy and nonviolence. When the church incorporated with the Roman state, it had to do away with that and created a new hybrid, which incorporated the veneer of Christianity, but with an imperial mission, and that was to simply conquer the world using this symbol and this ideology. That conquest had nothing to do with Christ. In fact, the symbol of Christ on a cross, to me, has always evoked the reality that the messenger, the original teacher, was killed by the church, and something else was put in its place. So it's this exposure of the false nature of Christianity in the world that's one of the best weapons to counter this, because part of that ideology that went along with this false religion is the idea that people are inherently fallen and corrupted, and at birth, the whole ideology of the fall and original sin, that serves as justification for any amount of brutality and genocide in the world. Because it's basically the idea that people are not sufficient or good in themselves, that they need changing, and if they won't change, then they can be eliminated. That's kind of the core idea behind genocide. And, you know, all of the laws, to give you an example, the laws behind the sterilizations that were brought in, it was always described in benign terms, like we're doing this to improve the genetic makeup of the human race. We want to eliminate inferior groups. I mean, all of that comes out of the original sin ideology, that there's some that are saved and some that are fallen. And as long as you have that ideology in the world, you're going to have genocide. So that's why I think that the genocide is essentially, at least in the European tradition, genocide is a religious ideology that came out of Christendom. And until we grasp that, it's going to keep repeating itself over and over.
So do you think that then there were the groups that were already existing and that were bidding for a world hegemony, if you will, whatever it is that these groups are after, and that they saw Christianity as this opportunity when it came along and hijacked it in the way that you're describing in order to push their agendas in a whole new way?
Well, yeah, I think it goes right back to Roman times. And there's various theories of, you know, the Illuminati and various secret societies that operate. I mean, I think any of those possibilities are true. But I think the bigger picture here is that it doesn't even matter what group is manipulating that. As long as you have that ideology, then anyone can latch onto it and use it as a justification for empire and war, as has happened all over the world. All the nations of Europe that have had empires are guilty of this themselves. It isn't just, you know, the British Empire operating over here that causes this. It's many. They all use the same ideology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the papal laws that were passed, the papal bulls of the 1500s, that justify the conquest of non-Christian lands. Those are still in effect. They've never been revoked. And, you know, it's an example of how really the ideology doesn't ever change. It just kind of modifies itself and modernizes. But really, the core idea is never altered.
But what sort of ideology are we talking about here? Because I think it's easy for average person to understand an elite group like trying to claim land and wipe out populations in order to seize that land and all the rest of it. But the agendas that you're describing seem to be a lot more complex and darker than that. I mean, how, for example, how does paedophilia rings and snuff movies and all the rest of it, how does that intersect with the more profane bid for land and for power that you're describing?
Right, well, I mean, I'm not a strict materialist in that I don't think that it's simply about people's desire for money and land. That's not the root cause of genocide. I mean, that's one of the factors. But at a more basic level, I do think that, you know, like on a spiritual level, you have a force at work which is trying to destroy innocence and feeds off the destruction of innocence. and creates a whole way of thinking whereby the innocence of the child, the innocence of the earth, the innocence of the woman is seen as a threat and has to be crushed and assimilated. And that's part of the whole, I mean, you know, that there's been some good things written about that. Rhianne Eisler, in her book, The Chalice and the Blade, she talks about how the early goddess traditions in the human race were replaced by the conquest model of this vengeful male god, a patriarchal god who goes out and whose symbol is the blade. We have this in the Latin language where the word for god, dominus, means conquest. Dominion and our whole system of law and politics and religion arise on the basis of this idea of domination. Mm. So dominating other souls, dominating the earth, it's all coming out of that spirit, if you like, of conquest as opposed to harmony and equality. So I think, you know, whatever interpretation you put on that, I think it's certainly something more than just desire for land and wealth.
So where does it all begin then? I mean, you spoke in the Unrepentant about the generations of trauma, and it's a fairly well-known factor that people who are abused as children often end up abusing children themselves. It's like these patterns, these wounds that just get passed on through generations. So is that what we're looking at here? These people who seem to be driven by mundane and profane bids for power or control and all the rest of it, are we actually looking at severely damaged people who have just been imprinted with these patterns of trauma and abuse and are unable to get free of them, and so just inflicting them on others?
Yes, I mean, that's how it perpetuates itself every generation. And it's not even just within a community when you see that operating. There's a whole history of that. Like when my ancestors came from Scotland after they had been driven out of the Highlands by the Clearances, they came to the Red River Settlement, what's Winnipeg in Canada. And these people, my ancestors, I mean, they were all traumatized. They had lost their language, they'd lost their land, they'd been denied the right to be who they are. And frankly, they began to inflict that same thing on the native people they encountered here. So if a people don't face their trauma, and the European tribes that were destroyed, I mean, we're all indigenous originally, and when we lost a lot of the culture that we knew that was ours, in that grief and that inability to recover it, we start inflicting it on others. But that's certainly what's happened. It's ironic because many of the ways and the languages and the beliefs of the native people here are very similar to the Gaelic people, my ancestors. Even some of the beliefs are very almost identical, and so there's. I know that when I got fired, when I went through this personally, there was a certain resonating that was going on in me, because in my genes, I carry the memory of having been driven forever from our land, and being denied that bond that had united us for thousands of years on that place, and you never recover from that loss, and you in that grief, you know, unless you face it, either as a person or as a people. You continue to perpetuate it on others, and I think that that's getting closer to what this is all about. It's not about just helping Native people or helping our victims. It's about looking at what happened to us and why we keep perpetuating this pattern of violence in the world.
So, do you have any thoughts? I mean, both as a researcher, as you are now, and as a Christian or Catholic or however you see yourself now, on how this began, on how these generations of trauma, the original wound. I mean, you discussed the fall, the idea of the fall and the original sin as being somehow flawed as ideas, but somehow at some point something went drastically wrong for the human race, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I don't know if you can point to a spot. Well, first of all, I was never a Catholic. I was a Protestant minister.
Okay.
I wouldn't call myself even a Christian. I don't see the need for that label. I think you can be a believer in Christ without being a Christian. You can believe in his teachings and that. But the whole question of where it began and how, I mean, I think that's really difficult to say historically. But I do know that in the wars of conquest that, you know, that developed 3,000-4,000 years ago in the human race, and the rise of the early city-states and how the power of kings always rested on religious legitimation of a priest there saying that this family has the right to be a king over you and command your labor and order you to go to war against people you don't even know and who haven't harmed you. They have that power because the gods have given them that power.
Mm.
So there is always a religious justification for these wars and the extermination. And that's why I think it's religion itself that has to be challenged, because, you know, I often say to people, well, if there is a loving creator, the last thing he or she would want in the world is religion, because it simply divides people.
Mm.
And no loving creator would want people to have a differential access to him or her. That is, some, you know, can stand in their grace and others can't. I mean, that's a human idea, not a divine idea. So I think the whole construction of religion is a reflection of human power and control. It has nothing to do with spiritual realities. And I think there's a recognition of that in many different religious traditions. I mean, but the reality is in the world that religion is political power. I mean, the Vatican is probably the best example of that, or the worst, in that it's really a political power in the world and always has been, and yet it poses as a religion and a spiritual body.
But do you ever wonder, Kevin, having to unflinchingly look at man's inhumanity to man, and the depravity and the distortion in the world, is there really an inhuman element at play here? Would you say, is there a non-human element, whether you'd call it demonic or whether you'd call it alien or something that we're not figuring into the equation if we try and interpret it simply in terms of human psychology and history?
No, yeah, I agree. You can't have a closed notion of this that it's simply a function of history or psychology or economics or anything. I think there are other elements at work, and if you call them demonic, it's funny. The term, of course, daemon in some languages simply means spirit, but our notion of a demon that is, or a force that is actively subverting the human soul and creating this destruction in the world. I believe that's at present, and in fact, I once participated in an exorcism when I was in Port Alberni, and I was definitely aware that there was another very destructive presence in the room that wasn't there at other times. And it's not something you can even put a name on. And when you try to name, part of the exorcism rite is you name the entity to draw it out of the person who's possessed. But what I said to the people afterwards is, it's not so much a matter of personalizing and individualizing this question of exorcism, because you could say the culture as a whole is possessed. I mean, the culture I live in is possessed with a great demon of greed and destruction. And how do you exorcise that? I mean, how do you look at the bigger demons that are possessing all of us in the world? I think, you know, those are the spiritual issues that have to be struggled with. And they're not easy to name, let alone even act on, because people are not really aware of what they're dealing with. But I think awareness of it comes through loss, through interaction with these forces, and being able to name what you're really dealing with. And like you said quite rightly, it's not just about, you know, politics and economics, because if it was, it could be changed and reformed and it would go away. Mm. But it never does seem to go away. And that's the thing that has got to be looked at. Is there some inherent flaw within us? Is there something acting on us?
Mm.
I don't have an answer for that, but it's almost like you have to judge by the outcome. By the results in the world, we know that there's something that's seeking our destruction.
Mm.
And we have to, on every level, kind of look at that and pose it and reassert life all the time.
So do you think that there's some aspect of our psyche then, collectively and individually, that could say that we've denied and cut off and suppressed, and even, we might even bring it down to our primal nature, which can be very destructive if it isn't correctly channeled. And that perhaps that this whole, not just the idea, but the reality of a satanic force is to do with our own shadow nature that we simply haven't dealt with and that has run amok.
Well, some people put that down to an evolutionary reason that, you know, we have different brains. We have a mammalian and a reptilian brain, and it's those impulses we have to struggle with. But again, that's a reductionist attitude that, you know, that there's simply the result of evolution and there's no other force. I do believe that there is a, if you want to call it a satanic force in the world. Like I say, I do believe, not necessarily that it's a person, or an entity, but it's simply it is a force in the world. I think it can take possession of people and whole institutions and societies.
Mm.
And it's got to be named as such and fought with spiritual weapons, which in many ways involve a personal discipline, you know, a commitment to truth and virtue and prayer and fasting and all the tools that are available for people who really want to engage with those powers. Unfortunately, you're not given a lot of help in that the very institutions that claim to be able to, you know, they claim that they're involved in these spiritual issues, you know, the churches, they are the worst perpetrators, and they're the most immersed in these evils.
Mm.
So people are often, you know, left with the feeling of helplessness, like, where do you go? I'm just always reminded of one of Jesus' sayings when he said, the kingdom of heaven is within you. And it's interesting, because in the Aramaic translation, it wasn't simply within, it also means around and about as well. The term means both inside and outside.
Mm.
So it's like, in other words, we're immersed in something greater than what we know. It's within us, but it's also around us, just like the nature of evil. And it's a matter of what you choose, what spirit you're going to choose to live in, and you become that spirit. So I think that that's part of the clue to how to resist these evils.
That leads right into my next question, which was, how do you feel, how would you interpret Jesus' saying to resist not evil in this context?
Well, again, that's an issue of translation. If you often in my sermons, I'd go to the original Hebrew and Greek and Aramaic and look at the words. As you know, the Bible's being translated and retranslated many times. And what the original meaning of, and I don't have it at hand, but anyone who gets who does the translation can find this. Resist not is not what it said originally.
Mm.
In the context of what he was saying, it meant have nothing to do with, was a more accurate translation of what he meant. So in other words, it doesn't mean don't oppose, don't resist. It simply says don't be like them.
Mm.
Act and be in a different way.
Mm.
That's an act of resistance when you look at it. The best kind of resistance you can have to somebody is to simply not be like them if they're being destructive.
Right.
And that's the message Jesus is always saying to people. Don't go along with what's evil. Resist it by being different, by standing on what you know is true,
mm.
right? And Gandhi and Martin Luther King and others taught people in nonviolence training is all about that. You stand in your own sense of truth. You don't have to fight somebody physically or forcefully, but your example is opposed and resisting and breaking down what they're doing. A Hindu fellow once told me that it was like the belief that there's a cycle of violence in the world, and an act of nonviolence and not returning evil for evil slows down the wheel of destruction.
Mm.
And it's kind of a lovely image, but I think that's true, that we simply don't participate, not resist, but don't participate in the evil you see around you. I think that that is closer to the meaning of what he was about.
Mm. Well, it's, isn't it, it's something like, rather than saying no to evil or satanic forces or however we perceive them, saying yes to the inverse, saying yes to Christ, saying yes
exactly.
to life. Because, I mean, in terms of simple physics, whatever we resist becomes stronger because
right.
we add our force to it.
Yeah.
So then we're sort of entering into the circle with the adversary and actually giving him or it our power, whereas if we simply turn away and turn to a positive mode of action that in a sense has been, we could have been provoked or goaded into positive action by experience of negative, then by that act we cancel out.
I agree with you. I think that that's really part of our strategy, has to be exactly like that. And it's also a way to sustain people, because you can't sustain people in this fight simply by confrontation all the time. I mean, it's very draining. It's better to build up an alternative to people, something they can live in and support and hold up,
mm.
rather than fighting an enemy all the time. So, I mean, yeah, I think it makes sense on a practical level too.
Well, there's something that struck me on this subject in Unrepentant. I believe it was. I've also been listening to your audio, where you talked about how the government apologized for the residential schools for the genocide, but then didn't offer to do anything about it.
Yep.
And that this was essentially was experienced by native peoples as the reopening of the wound.
Yep.
And And so it was sort of adding insult to injury. But it occurred to me as you're speaking that, because then you also talked about how activism is a way for these native people to find their voice, tell their stories, and then this leads to healing, transformation. For example, the one of the Native Americans who was an alcoholic for 30 years or something, and then and then quit as soon as he began telling his story. So, looking at this, it occurred to me that on the one hand, you've got these agendas of abuse and genocide and all the rest of it, and the powers behind it simply making a token show of apology, but not making any attempt to make amends, and how that's it's reopening the wound, which could have two effects. One is it would allow the native people or the individuals who've been abused in this way or betrayed, it gives them an opportunity to heal the wound by reopening it, you know, because then their awareness is back on the wound. But also potentially it creates anger against the government. And so it just struck me, I mean, it seems like a very delicate thing that one has to be impeccable when dealing with forces and intelligences like this who are apparently without compassion, without concern. But potentially what they're doing, even in their insensitivity or their brutality and all the rest of it, potentially is providing an opportunity for us to heal and to acknowledge our own wounds.
Yeah, well, as long as there's truthfulness involved. But what I witnessed in the so-called apology was not truthful at all. Don't forget that the word apology is a double meaning in English.
Mm-hmm.
And an apology or an apologetic in the English tradition is also can mean a defense of one's own actions. You know, the apology of Socrates, in which he's justifying his philosophy and his life, I mean, apologia, you know, it's a way to defend oneself.
Right.
And that was very much the message when the Prime Minister here was speaking.
Mm.
It was acknowledging, appearing to acknowledge something, yet at the same time saying nobody is ultimately liable for this.
Mm.
He said, yeah, basically the message was there were criminal acts that occurred, but there will be no criminal prosecution, even though we know very well who the guilty actors and institutions are in this.
Mm.
So in a way, it was the way white society in Canada was letting itself off the hook and kind of absolving itself from any responsibility. That was the basic intent of it. And proof of that is when the native people accept the, you know, the paltry sum that's being offered to them, about $10,000 for a whole lifetime of pain and suffering, you know, in order to get that money, they have to sign what's called an indemnification agreement, whereby they don't hold the churches that caused this terror in their life, they don't hold them accountable in any way. They can't sue them, ever.
Right.
And so really it's a way to protect the perpetrators under the guise of, quote, healing. So we have to really be careful of the word, because it's used by people who have a lot to hide, the guilty actors. It's used as a smokescreen behind which they can avoid responsibility. And that's a very deceitful kind of thing to happen. So that has got to be named and resisted by putting forward an alternative. And that is, well, we need a real inquiry. We need truth-telling. We need the whole culture to go through a catharsis, like Germany did after World War II, in which we put people on trial, not as punishment, but to say, we are going to take ownership of this. We are going to acknowledge what we did. We're going to name what we did. We're going to ask forgiveness by being different, by not doing it anymore, by not continuing to throw Native people off their land and raping the land and causing this destruction, which is all just a reflection of the same genocide. So, you know, if those kind of concrete steps can happen, then I guess you could say, you know, after generations of this, healing might occur, but it's too easy a thing to say, here, take some money and go heal. That isn't what happens. And in fact, a lot of the Native people I work with, if you hand them money, they'll go kill themselves with it. They'll drink themselves or overdose with drugs. And people in that condition, you don't hand money to if you're really concerned about.
Sure. Yeah, no, I certainly didn't mean to suggest that the government was in any way consciously assisting with the healing process, but unconsciously, despite itself, it's as though, I mean, to bring it to religious terminology, if everything is an aspect of the divine, everything is a manifestation of God, then that would include Satan, like in the book of Job.
Right.
God dispatches Satan to do his worst in order to test Job. And I just wonder if this isn't a way to navigate these very tricky and very oppressive times that we're in.
Yeah, is by, oh, I agree. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of truth to that, in that the very fact of them acting that way, we can often define ourselves in opposition to something that is obviously wrong, and that has to rear its ugly head first for us to see really what we're part of, and to develop something in the other direction. So it's a dialectic, if you like, you know, and it's, yeah, I see that happening all the time. So there's certainly value, yeah, of course.
Mm. Something else occurred to me while I was listening to many of your observations and experiences. It's to do with something that, I mean, talk about the systematic destruction of the Native American people and how it begins with the destruction of their culture, the destruction of their national identity. Mm-hmm. And I've read about this in other areas. It's called destroying the tonal. The tonal being just that, really, the one sense of identity. It occurred to me also in talking about these generational wounds that the white man, that's us, also had his tonal destroyed a long, long time ago. Unlike the Native American people who had their tonal intact, at least for the last, until the last few hundred years now. So we can actually observe this process. And it just seems that for example, we have the contradiction of, on the one hand, as the white race, we're aware of having been guilty by association with this destruction of a national identity or racial identity and of millions of people. But on the other hand, we in the Western world, we romanticize Native Americans and the whole culture of shamanism, ayahuasca and all the rest of it, which is growing stronger now. And there seems to be a very basic schizophrenia there, which I find somewhat suspicious. And I wonder if it relates to what you're talking about, is like denying our own culture, denying our own wounds by feeling guilty and trying to somehow compensate for that by, on the one hand, you know, we degrade the Native American, on the other hand, we romanticize him.
Well, certainly a common pattern. You see that all over in the colonial world. Of the example of that in Canada is the superintendent of Indian Affairs, Duncan Campbell Scott. He was a poet who wrote these, you know, romantic verses about the noble savage. And he was enacting policies causing mass destruction and genocide all over the country. So, yeah, that does happen. And don't forget that, you know, the basic act of genocide is theft and cultural appropriation of somebody else's language and mannerisms. That's part of the whole process of genocide. So, you know, when you see people in Europe dressing up like Plains Indians and romanticizing the culture, we've been doing that for a long time. They did the same thing. It was fashionable in English society after the Highland clearances for everyone to wear kilts, you know, and to claim this kind of pseudo-Highland culture. It's part of the way that you steal another person's soul and culture. It's part of the same process, and we continue to do it today because we've been trained to do it. We think it's all right to go and do that everywhere in the world, to take what isn't ours. We're children of empire. That's how we're taught to think and behave. So we have to kind of look in the mirror and turn the mirror on ourselves and see all of this is a reflection of empire, really.
Mm. Well, so, I mean, this behavior could relate to, as you've discussed, with the generational wound, the fact that if the white race had its own racial identity, its own tonal destroyed systematically, then it would be, in a symbolic sense, at least soulless in the way that Native American people have often perceived the white man. No?
Right. Very much. And there is a yearning among people who have been, you know, cleansed themselves, stripped of their own culture, and have very little except this modern corporatized, you know, culture. There's a yearning to go back and recover something, but we don't know how to do it. And so we kind of live vicariously through our victims, through the indigenous people. And that could also be part of the reason we romanticize them, because, you know, we want to be like them again, but we don't know how.
To reconnect to the earth again?
Absolutely. That's really what it's all about. We've lost our natural connection with that cycle. You know, it's whenever I get really down, I go and lie on the earth for for half an hour, and I'm instantly made whole again just by doing that.
Mm.
And the megahertz in our brain is identical to that of the energy coming out of the Earth. I mean, we are in harmony with the Earth far more than we realize, but you don't know that when you're locked away in a city or in an office.
Mm.
And it's part of that yearning to get back to what's real. That's, and, you know, indigenous people are the embodiment of that for us, or at least the ideal of indigenous people.
So, I mean, because with the globalization and all that, I mean, particularly in the last 100 and even the last 50 years, we're seeing, these indigenous cultures getting either wiped out or just homogenized and kind of converted. I mean, it seems that even the most kind of far removed peoples somehow are inexorably drawn into the civilized sort of way of being very, very rapidly. There seems to be some basic strange appeal. Like in that movie, The Gods Must Be Crazy, where they find the Coca-Cola bottle and just everything goes to hell within a matter of weeks. It's almost as if civilization does cast a kind of hypnotic spell on us.
Also, and it also takes away any other options. I mean, the reality is you're not allowed to survive in any other way except by integrating into that market economy.
Mm.
Indigenous people who try to stay on the land and everything, they're driven off. They're not allowed to retain their hunting-gathering traditions. So it's also a question of, you know, your options are taken away from you.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, well, I think many of us who grow up in a civilized world, we really just don't know how to connect to the earth. It's this idea that's very romantic, but it seems to be outside our paradigm almost, as if we've created a new reality which is just as disconnected from the natural world as is humanly possible.
Yeah.
So how would you, as you are down in the trenches and on the front line dealing with this, how do you see, I mean, first of all, what do you hope to gain by what you're doing, and how do you see the immediate future?
Well, for me, it's never been a question of what I gain. I mean, anything I've gained has been inadvertent as a consequence of the work I do. I could never have expected that I'd be so enriched by the contact I've had with people and the way it's broadened me and opened my inner eye to what really I'm a part of, and that's something I would never trade for anything.
Mm.
So I've actually appreciated a lot of the suffering I went through because it's brought me here and brought me to a better place. But what I hope, you know, to see coming out of this is something that I see all the time, which is people are waking up to what we're doing to the earth and to one another. And there's a counter, you know, just as things are getting worse, there's a counter motion in the opposite way, away from this corporatized global culture. And I see that the awareness of this genocide is helping people take that step, because we see what we've done. When we see the details of what we do and continue to do, then we can act in a different way. And I just hope that, you know, it's one thing to call for inquiries and investigations, but the system isn't going to prosecute itself. It's not going to hold itself accountable.
Mm.
The only, you know, the best vengeance we can have against genocide is to simply cut ties with everything connected to it, including the way of thinking and the spirit around it, and start to act and be in a different way. And that takes a lifetime of effort, but it starts with the knowledge. And the knowledge comes out of suffering and what people are going through on the ground, so there's no substitute for staying close to those people and that truth of what people are going through every day.
Mm. Well, I mean, when we talked about paedophilia and this particular horrific reality and the way that people will actually suppress knowledge of it and just force themselves not to think about it because it's more than they can deal with, do you think that, I mean, this level of this kind of denial exists in us all, and so the idea, I mean, what I've seen in myself and in the world is that the stronger the power of truth becomes, potentially the more people are drawn to that. But on the other hand, something else happens, and that is the deeper people who are not ready to face the truth have to force themselves into untruth in order to escape the truth.
Yep.
And so have you seen and do you foresee like a growing schism in the species, is that those who are willing to align themselves with truth and those who aren't willing and so must go deeper and deeper into distortion?
I do, you know, and that's a good way to put it. I mean, it runs across all boundaries. It's not like there's one nation or group or class or, you know, that's better than others in terms of this. It cuts right across every group. there's a sorting out of humanity going on, and just like within ourselves, there's a sorting out that happens. And we can see these two tendencies clear, and that's part of our spiritual evolution, to have that inner sight, to see, you know, what we have to reject and what we have to accept and nurture within ourselves and around us. And so I think times like this are exciting in that sense. It's something like this couldn't have happened 30 or 40 years ago. I think that we've evolved in our, at least that minority of us who seem to be conscious of these things, we've evolved in our reaction time and our ability to speak more clearly about what's happening. I mean, growing up in the 60s, that wasn't there. You know, it took a lot longer for people to become aware about things. Maybe, I don't know, I don't want to say it's because of the communication technology now, but I think it's at a deeper level.
So, I mean, when you talk about a sorting of humanity, it's like a day of judgment when we have to face up to the truth of our lives, and, you know, individually and collectively. Is this something, do you think that the Christian myth of Armageddon is a sort of symbolic description of what we're actually faced with now as a species?
Well, not literally, but I mean, there is a judgment coming, and any environmentalist can tell you that, any scientist could tell you that there is a reckoning coming. And in many ways, people think we're past the point of no return in that. I know in my gut that we are going to go through a very, very bad time, and things can only get worse. And that will, as things get worse, it quickens our evolution. Those who are going to evolve, it'll quicken the process by which we can transcend that, and something else will be created. I do think that there's something much better standing in the wings for us, but it's only those who have their inner eye open who are going to be able to see it and embrace it. And I think that's part of the purpose of these troubles we're in right now.
So, like, the deeper the darkness becomes, the brighter the lights can shine within it.
So, do you mind if we kind of stop part one right now?
whenever you have to go, Kevin, we've almost covered an hour, and it's been fascinating talking to you. And before I let you go, perhaps you could give out the URLs and different things that the listeners can check into if they want to
My website is www.hiddenfromhistory.org, and that will allow you to see a lot of the work we do, and also our film on repentance is posted on there, along with testimonies from eyewitnesses and that. My email, which people can contact me at, is hiddenfromhistory, that's one word, hiddenfromhistory@yahoo.ca.
Okay, Kevin, well, thank you very much for talking
thank
to
you.
Me, and I really appreciate all the great work that you've done.
Well, thanks, and it was a good interview, thank you.
Against my prayers, stand a chance against my love. Your law, the gold stands. The old law, the gold stands. We shall live again. We shall live again. But she has red paint. She died of wounded knee, like a Latter-day Saint. You got the big drum in the distance, the blackbirds in the sky. That's the sound that you hear when the buffalo cries. But you don't stand a chance against my prayers. You don't stand a chance against my love. Our Lord, the gold stand. Long the ghost dance. We shall live again. We shall live again. We shall live again. Crazy Horse was a mystic. He knew the secret of the trance. Sitting Bull, the great apostle of the ghost stand. Come on, Comanche. Come on, Blackfoot. Come on, Shoshone. Come on, Shire. We don't sing them kind of songs no more.